Continuing in the sixth chapter, my understanding is that you reviewed quite a little bit in the last study. So we'll not spend a good bit of time doing that. But what we do see is that the author of the Hebrew epistle has expressed concern for the Hebrew Christians. What has been the primary focus of his concern? Randy? Falling back into Judaism, that's right. What is the severity of his concern? In other words, how bad can it become? They lose heaven to the extent they will not repent. It'll be beyond their ability for someone to restore them to repentance. But the writer, having stated those things, is concerned or is persuaded better things concerning them. Things that pertain to salvation. And he bases his argument, and I want to read verses 9 through verse 12, and then we'll pick up our study at verse 13. It says, "But beloved, we are persuaded better things of you, things that accompany salvation, though we thus speak. For God is not unrighteous to forget your work and the love which he showed toward his name, in that you ministered unto the saints and still do minister. And we desire that each one of you may show the same diligence unto the fullness of hope, even to the end, that ye be not sluggish, but imitators of them who through faith and patience inherit the promises." He's persuaded better things of them than the things that he has just mentioned. And he bases that confidence upon at least two things in these verses. What are they? Number one, God is not unrighteous to forget their work and the love which they showed toward his name, in that they ministered unto the saints and still do minister. As you'll turn over to the 10th chapter of the book of Hebrews, we see some of the things that they have already endured for the cause of Christ. In verse 32, he says, "But call to remembrance the former days, in which after ye were enlightened, ye endured a great conflict of sufferings, partly being made a gazing stock, both by reproaches and afflictions, and partly becoming partakers with them that were so used. For ye both had compassion on them that were in bonds, and took joyfully the spoiling of your possessions, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession and an abiding one. Cast not away, therefore, your boldness, which hath great recompense of reward, for ye have need of patience, that having done the will of God, ye may receive the promise." He recognizes that they have already participated in a relationship with their brethren when their brethren were suffering and sacrificing for the cause of Christ. Do we see that? God is not forgetful of those things. And then secondly, "We desire that each one of you may show the same diligence unto the fullness of the hope, even unto the end, that ye be not sluggish." The word sluggish in this passage is the same word that's used in verse 11, where he identifies some of them of being dull of hearing. The idea is that they not be dull in their relationship to Christ, but that they be diligent. And as they are diligent, of course, that's the opposite of laziness or indifference. The necessity of being diligent is seen in 2 Peter chapter 1, reading in verse 5. "Yea, and for this cause," or this very cause, "adding on your part all diligence." Now, diligence is something that we can do. In verse 10, "Wherefore, brethren, give the more diligence to make your calling and election sure. For if ye do these things, ye shall never stumble." So God does not forget our work and our labor of love. God is a just God, one that does not forget the works of the past, very much aware of the works that we engage in the present. And knowing this can be a source of great comfort to these Christians who are being tempted to give up the relationship that they have in Christ in order that they might go back to those things that existed under the law. But diligence, faith, and patience on our part, this is what the author desires for them, that his readers show the same diligence that they had shown in the past. Diligence regarding their assurance of hope. Diligence unto the end. In the third chapter, and in verse 6, of the book of Hebrews, he says, "But Christ as a son over his house, whose house are we, if we hold fast our boldness and the glorying of our hope firm unto the end." This diligence is something that is essential on their part, firm unto the end, if they are to receive the blessings that the writer would like for them to receive. And then in verse 12, that they be imitators of them who through faith and patience inherit the promises. Who would that be, do you suppose? Well, who is cited in the next few verses as an illustration of faith and patience? Abraham is. So they are to remember the faith and patience of such characters, such as Abraham, in order that they might grow and not reach the state that he has cautioned them about in the first 8 verses of this chapter. Now, beginning in the 13th verse, we learn that God keeps His promises. Verse 1, or verse 13, the first portion of this paragraph. For when God made promise to Abraham, since he could swear by none greater, he sware by himself, saying, Surely blessing I will bless thee, and multiplying I will multiply thee. And thus, having patiently endured, he obtained the promise. Well, let's talk just a little bit about Abraham. He's the example that God has set forth in these verses. And God made a promise unto Abraham. What was the promise that he had made unto Abraham? Randy?
Well, specifically, he made 3 promises.
All right, he did. All right. Let's turn back to Genesis chapter 22, I believe is where the reference is here. We could go back to Genesis chapter 12, where the promises were initially made. But in Genesis chapter 22, reading at verses 16 and 17, we see God swearing or taking an oath relative to these promises. And he said, By myself have I sworn, saith Jehovah, because thou hast done this thing, and hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, that in blessing I will bless thee, and in multiplying I will multiply thy seed as the stars of the heavens, and as the sand which is upon the seashore. And thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in thy seed shall all nations of the earth be blessed, because thou hast obeyed my voice. God could not swear by any greater, and of course that becomes the context of which we're reading in Hebrews the 6th chapter. And so he swore by himself the same 3 promises that we read in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1, 2, and 3, as we sometimes refer to them as the land promise, the nation promise, and the seed promise. In verse 14, he says, Surely blessing I will bless thee, and multiplying I will multiply thee, and thus having patiently endured, he obtained the promise. What was it, or how long did Abraham have to endure before he obtained any of these promises? God had made a promise unto Abraham initially that he would have a son. How old was Abraham when that promise was made? All right, how old was he when the child was born? Let's back up and rethink. How old was he when the promise was made? All right, he was about, look at Genesis chapter 12, about verse 7, I believe it is. Genesis 12, verse 7. I think that's the right verse. Genesis 12, verse 7. All right, he was 75 when the promise was initially made to him regarding the son. How old was he then when the son was born? 100. So he waited for a long time before the promise of the son was fulfilled, did he not? And then when he came into the promised land, what did he find out about the land itself? There were people there. And so consequently, it was not going to be his in fact, but his in promise. It was going to be his in fact when he had descendants 400 years down the pike that the land would be his. So Abraham patiently endured, the text tells us. He obtained the promise. He obtained the promise of a son. He obtained the promise of the land in the future of his descendants. And then way down the pike, of course, the promise of the seed through which forgiveness would be offered to all. Now, for men swear, verse 16, men swear by the greater, and in every dispute of theirs the oath is final for confirmation. God made promise to Abraham and bound that promise with an oath. Now, for men to swear something, that means the end of dispute, generally. That was the case when Abimelech and Abraham had some trouble, and there was a conference, if you please, as to whether or not they would deal forthrightly and honestly with each other. And so we read about that in the text of Genesis chapter 21, several verses there, beginning at verse 32. But we find that that was finally settled by an oath. Abimelech took an oath of Abraham, and that settled the problem. That oath or covenant was sealed with the offering of certain animals. In Genesis chapter 47 and in verse 31, there was concern on Jacob's part as to where he would be buried. And you remember that he took an oath from Joseph that he would be buried in the promised land, the land of Canaan. So an oath settled the matter, and an oath became that which is the assurance among matters of men. And so to assure us of the unchangeableness of God's promise, God also swore an oath. And this provided double assurance that he would keep his promise. One, because it's impossible for God to lie, but because God had made promise and had confirmed that with an oath. Now in verse 17, it says, "Wherein God being minded to show more abundantly unto the heirs of the promise, the immutability of his counsel interposed with an oath." Two or three things we need to ask in that passage. Number one, God minded to show more abundantly unto the heirs of the promise. Who is that? Who are the heirs of the promise? David?
We are.
That's right. We are the heirs of the promise. And there's things that we need to know beyond doubt. We need to have great confidence in. And so, God being mindful to show more abundantly unto the heirs of the promise, the immutability of his counsel. What does the immutability of his counsel imply? What's the word immutability mean?
Unchangeable.
That's right. When God says something, it doesn't change. And then thirdly, he says the immutability of his counsel, he interposed with an oath. When God wanted us to know that he's faithful and true to what he says, he interposed with an oath so that we would not have doubt regarding the promises that he has made. Verse 18, that by two immutable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we may have strong encouragement who have fled for refuge to lay hold of the hope set before us. Two or three things in verse 18 that I want us to talk about. One is that we're seeking for refuge. Who are we seeking and why? Why is it called refuge? All right. The rest that we're seeking that was discussed in the latter part of the third chapter, the first part of the fourth chapter, yes. We're seeking rest. We're seeking refuge in Christ because of sin. We're trying to find something that will relieve us of the penalty of sin. Yes, Randy?
Clear this up for me. Verse 18, so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, what are the two unchangeable things?
Very good question. His oath and his promise.
Better listed in 17.
Yes. His oath and his promise. The very fact that God made a promise, it's unchangeable. The very fact that he interposed with an oath makes it doubly unchangeable.
What's the difference between an oath and a promise?
Well, God made promise to Abraham, as we read in Genesis 12. But in Genesis 22, he swore to Abraham. Now, oaths are interesting things. In Ecclesiastes, the fifth chapter, oaths are discussed. And it says in verse 4, when thou vowest a vow. Now, is there any practical difference between a vow and an oath? No. When thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not to pay it. For he hath no pleasure in fools. Pay that which thou vowest. Better it is that thou shouldest not vow than that thou shouldest vow and not pay. The idea is here of interposing with a confident affirmation that you'll do what you've said you will do. So when you make a promise and then you interpose with an oath, there's just a doubly sure affirmation that you'll do what you said you'll do.
Double dog swear.
Double dog swear, yeah. Okay.
So, I mean, it
strengthens the promise. It strengthens the promise, yes. Okay, Donna? Ecclesiastes 5, verse 4. Okay, I see another hand. Joey?
It's kind of odd because on the surface, because God's promise doesn't need no strengthening.
That's true.
You know, so it's a little peculiar that there would be something needed beyond a promise from God.
But keep in mind, he's making this promise to men. Mm-hmm. And men perhaps need something more. And that's what we see in the reference to this. Yes? Yes, I think that's exactly the case. Yes, Randy?
What's interesting is that in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus forbids us to do that.
Okay. Yes, you may.
Matthew 5:33, again, you have heard the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. But I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you make an oath on your head, that you do not make one hair white or black. But let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no, anything beyond the beast is of evil.
Well, that's right. And of course, Jesus is simply saying, do what you say you will do. Vows or oaths under that period of time were kind of interesting things. Some thought that if they swore by one thing, then it really didn't mean as much as if they had sworn by something else. There were greater and lesser oaths. The Jews, for example, would swear by Jerusalem, by the temple. The Greeks and the Romans would swear by the souls of those who were dead, the ashes of their fathers, or their life, or the life of a friend, or by their head, or by their right hand. Now, those would be examples of lesser oaths. But greater oaths would be an appeal to God the Jews would engage in. The heathen man, the Gentile, would appeal to their superior deities, Jupiter, Neptune, or Pluto. And so some of these things made a difference to them. If they would swear a lesser oath, then they didn't feel as obligated to keep it as they did if they swore by a greater oath. Now, that's what Jesus is dealing with. He said, if you say you will do it, then do it. You don't make this contrast between a lesser oath and a greater oath. You let your yea be yea, your nay, nay. You do what you say you will do. Period. Okay?
And yet we still, in our courts, we swear on the Bible.
We do. And the question is often raised, is it right to make an oath or on grave occasions of importance? Or is God acting inconsistent with his own revelation in Matthew 5? Now that's a question that has to be asked. And of course the answer is the practice of swearing has been used to punctuate, I think is probably the correct word, ordinary conversation. And such use of God's names and attributes is sinful. We see that in Exodus chapter 20, to not use God's name in vain. And so also is the habit of swearing by heaven or by the earth or by other creature. In fact, the passage has really nothing to do with solemn civil and religious oaths. James 5, I think verse 12, implies the same thing. When you lay your hand upon the Bible and you promise to tell the truth, well, does that mean that you would not have told the truth otherwise? Terry?
No.
Daryl?
Kind of the way I see it, I think Jesus is telling the people to, and as he's telling us, that let the content of your character be such that you don't need to be able to, because it's the same today. I don't know a whole lot about it, but I hear that Abraham Lincoln was called Honest Abe, and that.
Yeah. Well, that's right. But in our civil affairs, sometimes we sign that what we have said is true to the best of our knowledge and ability. And I dare say that most all of you have filled out some form where you've signed your name that the above information is true to the best of your knowledge and ability. And that's all you're doing. You're agreeing that what you have said is true. And so you're saying what I have said is true. Yea is yea and nay is nay. So rather than spend a great deal of time on that, I think we just need to acknowledge that such is not a wrong thing to do. And sometimes it becomes necessary to satisfy the legal requirements of a civil court. Randy?
I was just going to
the only reason that I considered it is because I understood the words that I was saying. I was not swearing by the Bible. I was not swearing by God.
You were not taking a lesser oath or a greater oath.
They say, repeat after me. You know, I solemnly swear to tell the whole truth, the truth, the whole truth, and I believe.
Right.
So help me God. You're asking God's help to make sure you tell the truth.
That's right.
It's not what Jesus said.
No. No. No, it isn't the same. No. David?
Well, yeah, I started over my placing hand, does that mean you're going to tell the truth now? If you told me something, I would trust and stuff, your character is such that I would trust you, but you might be in a civil court and no one would know you or your character. I've been to court cases and no one been there and in there.
Right.
So that's, I think, the way that government gets going to make it more, I don't want to call it more violent, but being in is perjury is a crime, and you can go to jail for that. So that should be the...
Yeah, it's a sin, too.
Yeah, well, it is a sin. But I'm talking about most of the court cases, not all of them, most of the court cases are young people, maybe who are not Christians.
That's right. I mean, all you're doing is promising you'll tell the truth. Now, in this instance, that's not what God was doing. God took an oath, and God promised, as you said, double dog.
I think I'm mixing up expressions.
Yeah, promise.
Double dog dare.
Yeah. Well, the idea is you've got the promise of God punctuated with his oath.
Yeah.
Randy?
I was just going to read the reference you made about swearing. Woe to you blind guides who say, whoever swears by the temple, that is nothing. But whoever swears by the gold of the temple is obligated. You fools and blind men, which is more important, the gold or the temple that sanctified the gold? And whoever swears by the altar, that is nothing. But whoever swears by the offering on it, he is obligated. You blind men, which is more important, the offering or the altar that sanctifies the offering? Therefore, whoever swears by the altar swears by both the altar and by everything on it. And whoever swears by the temple swears by both the temple and by him who dwells there. Whoever swears by heaven swears by both the throne of God and by him who sits upon it.
Okay, and the point is, you do what you say you will do.
The point is, they're hypocritically thinking about it.
Yes. Okay, that's right. Joey?
No, I don't.
Okay. All right. Let's return then to the text. In verse 18, that by two immutable things, that is, the oath and the promise of God, in which it is impossible for God to lie, we may have strong encouragement. Some translations, I think, use the expression strong consolation. What is that?
Well, you know, he's got both promises.
Okay, so we can be encouraged
because
we know he'll keep the promise, and he already has. Who have fled for refuge to lay hold of the hope that is set before us, or the hope set before us. The hope that's set before us, what is that? Salvation, heaven itself, where Jesus has entered before us. In verse 19 he says, which we have as an anchor of the soul, a hope both sure and steadfast, and entering into that which is within the veil. Whether as a forerunner, Jesus entered for us, having become a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. We have a hope. We have a hope that is described here as the anchor of the soul. And as the anchor of the soul, it reaches behind the veil where Jesus is, behind the veil where our anchor is sure and steadfast. Now, as we reflect further upon our hope, what we see in these verses is an argument that the apostle or the Hebrew writer has developed that returns the readers back to the thing that he's been discussing, and that is the priesthood of Christ after the order of Melchizedek. We find somewhat of a parenthesis statement in verse 5 from chapter 5, verse 11, on through the remaining portion of chapter 6. This parenthesis statement has to do with their spiritual maturity. And so with this finely crafted argument, the author has returned his readers back to the original subject matter in verse 20 concerning the priesthood of Christ. Our spiritual security is based first upon the character of God, who is not unjust to forget our work and the labor of love. He keeps His promises. God has promised and sworn with an oath concerning the priesthood of the Messiah. And this priesthood, Jesus is now in heaven at the right hand of God and becomes the basis of our hope, for which reason we should seek to learn what we can about the priesthood of Christ. Now, we must be careful in this context not to become sluggish. We must be careful not to lack in diligence. We must imitate the faith and the patience of those like Abraham who obtained God's promises for them. And so this context becomes very important to us. This hope that's described as an anchor, what does an anchor do for a ship?
Keeps it from drifting.
All right. Hope is that which keeps us from drifting. I think sometimes we underestimate the power of hope. Open your Bibles to Romans, the 8th chapter, and look, if you would, please, at verse 24. He says, "For in hope were we saved, but hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopeth for that which he seeth? But if we hope for that which we see not, then do we with patience wait for it." What is it that hope helps you to do? It helps you to wait. Hope helps you to wait. If somebody promises a child a piece of candy if they do such and such, the idea is to invoke within the child the patience to do what you've asked them to do so you get the piece of candy, right? You get the reward. Now we see that. God holds before us the hope of heaven, something that's desirable for us, something that's available for us, something that's obtainable for us if we wait. Turn in your Bible, if you will, to Isaiah chapter 40, where we see the importance of waiting. Isaiah chapter 40. Reading beginning at verse 27, the question is asked, "Why sayest thou, O Jacob, and speakest, O Israel, my way is hid from Jehovah, and the justice due to me is passed away from my God? Hast thou not known? Hast thou not heard? The everlasting God, Jehovah, the creator of the ends of the earth, fainteth not, neither is weary. There is no searching of his understanding. He giveth power to the faint, and to him that hath no might he increaseth strength. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But they that wait for Jehovah shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint." Isn't that a promise that God is making to those who would be faithful to Him, those who would wait upon Him? Now there's the challenge. Hope provides the ability to wait, to be patient, and to wait. Yes, Dale? That's Isaiah chapter 40, verses 27 through 31. Okay? Waiting is not easy. And there may be all kinds of obstacles along the way that interfere. But hope provides the security to wait, does it not? And so hope becomes valuable to us. The Apostle Paul, when he's writing in the Ephesian letter, describes one hope. And in the Colossian letter, the first chapter, he tells us what that is. Colossians chapter 1 at verse 5, he says, "Because of the hope which is laid up for you in the heavens, whereof ye heard before of the word of the truth of the gospel." The hope that is laid up in the heavens. The same apostle writing to young Timothy said in 2 Timothy chapter 4, beginning at verse 6, "For I am already being offered, and the time of my departure is come. I have fought the good fight, I have finished the course, I have kept the faith. Henceforth there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, shall give to me at that day, and not to me only, but also to all them that have loved his appearing." Does that give you encouragement? To know that you can have what Paul had, that you can anticipate the very thing that Paul anticipated, the hope of heaven. And so, Daryl?
This word hope. I'm learning that, and I believe it's a true spread across the board, that no great undertaking in life. I'm close to finishing without hope. And I read a wonderful statement that said,
Well, that's true. The athlete who engages in various sports activities, if he doesn't see the end, the possible goal that he can achieve, then he's not going to practice like he should in order to reach that end. The person that's in school is not going to achieve as well.
I think of joy on guitar.
Okay.
They countless hours, some probably very inconvenient, and as we say, woodshed practice.
Okay.
Michelangelo said, "People who call hard at work for mine to become this great artist, they would think it's so wonderful."
Okay. Chris?
Wasn't it Paul, Ephesians 1:18, that prayed that the brethren of Ephesus would have the eyes of their heart enlightened so they could see the hope of his calling?
That's right.
He knew that they needed to see the reality of what they were working.
That's right. We need to see the reality of what we're working toward and see the possibility of achieving that. That's right. Okay? Yes. That's interesting. Okay. That's interesting. Now, in verse 19, when he describes hope, he describes it as an anchor of the soul, a hope both sure and steadfast, entering into that which is within the veil. The idea of our hope entering into that which is within the veil, whether as a forerunner Jesus entered for us. Jesus became the pioneer. He became the scout, if you please, who treaded the path on before us and entered into that which is within the veil so that our hope can be firmly secured. The same thing that an anchor does for a ship. It keeps it steadfast. And our anchor is where Christ is. That gives us strong consolation or encouragement. Now in verse 20, as he continues, he said, having become a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. That little statement just kind of sticks in there to blend everything together. Because that's what he's introduced back over in the fourth chapter, as you recall, in the 14th verse. Having then a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we have not a high priest that cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but one that hath been tempted in all points like as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore draw near with boldness unto the throne of grace, that we may receive grace and receive mercy and may find grace to help us in time of need. And then in the early part of the fifth chapter, he speaks concerning those things necessary to a priesthood. And then at verses 5 and 6, he quotes from the Psalms, Psalms chapter 110. And in verse 4, thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek, verse 6. Now having introduced that thought, he leaves it because of their state of immaturity. And now he's returning to that in the 7th chapter, verse 1. Any thoughts or comments before we get into the 7th chapter? Randy?
The reference he makes is the one seen to the veil.
Uh-huh.
The one which enters within the veil. It's not going unnoticed when he's talking to Hebrews, because they know that.
All right, that's true. Good point.
The veil, the Titan, I guess, is what I'm getting at. He's making reference to the veil of the temple, which separates Holy Holies.
Right.
Which is the type of heaven, I guess.
Right. Right.
But the hope has entered within the veil. The hope is identified as the anchor of the soul. But then it says where Jesus is entered.
That's right.
Jesus is our hope.
That's right.
Jesus is entered in behind the veil as our high priest. He is our mediator.
All right. That's right. And without that, we'd have nothing. We must understand that.
The term of anchor sailing in the 1600s, 1700s, the term casting your anchor to the windward. And what would happen when they go into channels and they didn't have room to tack back and forth because the narrow and wind was so strong, and that's kind of a last resort, they would throw their anchor out on the windward. And pull them off the rocks, so they don't crack and stuff. And that's that
That's right. My understanding is that an anchor in ancient writings has been used to indicate a sign of hope. And so it is defined here. Okay? Any other comments or questions on the sixth chapter? Yes. The last part of chapter 4 and the first part of chapter 5? Absolutely. The Apostle Paul is describing what he could see without his eyes, so to speak.
Yeah, walking by faith.
Walking by faith. And what Paul could see, the unseen, is described in chapter 5 in verse 1. He says, "For we know that if the earth and the house of our tabernacle be dissolved, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens." This is what he longed for. This was his hope. Yes, I think that's a very good observation. Anything else? All right. When we look into the seventh chapter, we see an outline of arguments that are made to establish the priesthood of Christ. I want you to listen carefully as we go over these. Number one, in the outline, verses 1 through 10, the priesthood after the order of Melchizedek is superior to that of the Levitical order. That's just a simple statement of fact. That's discussed in these verses. Number one, Melchizedek was priest as well as king, and Abraham paid tithes to him and received blessings from him. Melchizedek appears without predecessor or successors. Now we're going to talk about that in chapter 7, verses 1 through 10. In chapter 7, I'm sorry, David. Genesis 14. That's interesting. Yes. Yes, that's true. Okay. That's true. In chapter 7, verses 11 through 19 in our outline, the Levitical priesthood and the law of Moses were both abrogated on account of their insufficiency, and a better ground of hope brought in through the priesthood of Christ. In chapter 7, verses 20 through 22, we're going to be discussing the superiority of Christ's priesthood from the standpoint of it being unlike the Levitical priesthood. It was inaugurated with an oath. Verses 23 through verse 25 of the 7th chapter. The frequent changes in the Levitical priesthood occasioned by the death of the high priest is contrasted with the ever-enduring and unchangeable character of Christ's priesthood. In fact, from the inauguration of the Levitical priesthood to the birth of Christ, there were 67 different high priests. From the beginning of the Levitical priesthood to the destruction of the city of Jerusalem, there were 81 high priests, depending on who you read after. If you read after Josephus, he says there was 83. Different high priest. In chapter 7, verses 26 through 28, we see the superiority of Christ's priesthood proved from his own pure and spotless character and from the perfection of one offering which he made for the sins of the world. And then when we get into the 8th chapter, verses 1 through 5, we see the priesthood of Christ is superior, further demonstrated from the higher and more exalted sphere of his ministry as he is on the right hand of God, a heavenly tabernacle constructed by himself and not man. Now that gives you the gist of what we're going to be talking about in the 7th and into the first portion of the 8th chapter. Now in the 7th chapter, beginning at verse 1, we see thus far in our study we have seen the written mention of Melchizedek, or the writer mentioned Melchizedek, and that Jesus is priest after the order of Melchizedek. But now the writer returns to this theme of the priesthood of Melchizedek. And since this subject is what I think the writer would consider meat instead of milk, we want to consider it very carefully in our study tonight and in the ongoing lessons as we study the priesthood of Melchizedek and compare that with the superior priesthood of Christ. In verse 1 of chapter 7, "For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of God Most High, who met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him. What reference is made here? What Old Testament text? Genesis 14, that's right, beginning at verse 18 through about verse 20 specifically. To whom also Abraham divided a tenth part of all, being first by interpretation king of righteousness, and then also king of Salem, which is king of peace, without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like unto the Son of God, abideth a priest continually. The historical record, as far as the biblical account is concerned, for our information, how many passages are there that tell us about Melchizedek? There's the one in Genesis 14. There's one in Psalms 110. And then what we read here in Hebrews. So our knowledge of Melchizedek is very much limited. And as far as the record is concerned, we see read of Melchizedek, first of the Battle of the Kings in Genesis 14, in which Lot was captured and then rescued by Abraham. And upon his return, Abraham is met by Melchizedek, who was identified as king of Salem. Where is Salem believed to be? Jerusalem, that's right. He's also identified as priest of the Most High God. Now, in this meeting, two things happen. Number one, Melchizedek blesses Abraham. And number two, Abraham pays tithes to Melchizedek. Now, that becomes foundational to the argument that the Hebrew writer is making. In these verses, I want you to remember that, but let's back up just a little bit. When we talk about Melchizedek being without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like unto the Son of Man, abideth a priest continually. We have to raise the question, who is Melchizedek? Some have offered all kinds of foolish notions about who Melchizedek is. Some have believed that he's an angel. Some say that Melchizedek was the Old Testament character Enoch. Others have said that Melchizedek is the pre-incarnate Christ, that this is actually Jesus that we're talking about in this text. I think all of those are foolishness. Melchizedek was a man. He was a king. He was a unique king. He also served as priest, and that's what we know about Melchizedek from this passage. The description that is given regarding Melchizedek, the fact that he is described as without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, simply discusses the obscurity with which Melchizedek enters into history and enters or exits the stage of history. We don't know much about him. We find that he was king not because of a particular lineage. He was priest not because of a particular lineage. We see him not beginning. We do not read of his ending as far as priest and king is concerned. So he's a unique character in Old Testament history. But the thing that becomes more important, I think, for our purposes and our discussion is found in verses 4 through verse 9. When it says, "Now consider how great this man was, unto whom Abraham the patriarch gave a tenth out of the chief spoils. And they indeed of the sons of Levi that receive the priest's office have commandment to take tithes of the people according to the law, that is, of their brethren through these have come out, or though these have come out of the loins of Abraham." Now let's talk about that just a little bit. What's the Hebrew writer's point? When Abraham engaged in battle, he came and brought unto Melchizedek a tenth of the spoils. He paid tithes unto Melchizedek. All right, that's here. And what we see in these verses is the less is great is blessed by the greater, and the one who is greater receives tithes of the lesser. Now that's the point that's being established here. Now what's the significance of that point? Christ. All right, say again.
Christ is greater
than Melchizedek. Who was it that had paid tithes to Melchizedek? All right, who through Abraham then paid tithes to Melchizedek? The Jewish people, that's right. Those who had descended from Abraham. And in particular, who was it? The Levitical priesthood, that's right. So this shows that the Levitical priesthood is not as great as the priesthood of Melchizedek. Now, if Christ is both king and priest after the order of Melchizedek, it shows that the priesthood of Christ is greater than that of the Levitical priesthood who paid tithes to Melchizedek. Okay, David? All right.
The priesthood come about because of sin, not in the case of Melchizedek, where I think his name means righteousness.
Well, it does, as it's described in these earlier verses, king of righteousness.
Yeah. So that would be a whole different circumstance than the priesthood come about.
That's right. That's right. That's right. So the writer is making a very valid point that the Levitical priesthood is inferior to the priesthood of Christ, based upon the fact that the Levitical priesthood through Abraham had paid tithes to someone else, to Melchizedek. And Christ is priest after the order of Melchizedek. Okay? Carol?
Can I see if I'm understanding the dots that you're connecting it? The Jewish people paid a tenth to the Levitical priests. The Levitical priests were descendants of Abraham, so through him, they
That's right. That's right. That's right. You've got it nailed. And so the point being, therefore, is that the Levitical priests are inferior to the priesthood of Christ. Christ is priest after the order of Melchizedek. That's right. That's right. Okay. Now let's read the rest of this context. It says, and that indeed, verse 5, the sons of Levi that received the priest's office have commandment to take tithes of the people according to the law, that is, of their brethren, through though these have come out of the loins of Abraham. But he whose genealogy is not counted from them hath taken tithes of Abraham, and hath blessed him that hath the promises. But without any dispute, the less is blessed of the better. And here men that die receive tithes, but there one, of whom it is witnessed that he liveth. And so to say, through Abraham, even Levi, who receiveth tithes, hath paid tithes. For he was yet in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him. Isn't that an argument? That's an argument that becomes hard to unravel, isn't it? So we'll stop with that and start with verse 11 next time.
Wait, one more question.
One more question, okay. I'm sure there is. Yes.
We'll
have to talk about that later. Yeah. To be continued.